This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Terrence Pipkins describes puppetry as composing a symphony in 3D. And just one quick glimpse at his work illuminates exactly what he means. His puppets are carefully designed to make movement look graceful and effortless. Lions throw their head back to roar, and spiders scurry on all eight legs. Terrence's art hasn't always been this intricate, but he has always had a knack for making something out of nothing. As a kid growing up in the projects outside of Pittsburgh, he and his friends made toys from used popsicle sticks and rubber bands. He spent a lot of time doodling and drawing. Later on, Terrence turned to rap and graffiti to make sense of his changing social and political environment, but it wasn't until a chance encounter with Fred Rogers from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood that he began to think more seriously about puppetry. Terrence has been living and working as an artist and a teacher in North Carolina since 2005 and performs under the name Jaghetto. He's with me in the studio today. Terrence Pipkins, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Oh, glad to be here, Frank. Pleasure and an honor.
Take us back to those early years outside of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, you know, it's the stereotypical story of a young black male in America came up in the projects. I didn't have much because, you know, there's a lot of resources, had a lot of family and friends. So it was still like a community raising a child scenario as a child. So, you know, I have really good memories, but I've seen a lot of traumatic things happen too, as far as, you know, living in the streets and seeing adults live.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and you had a lot of family around you, right?
Yes.
And your mom especially was trying to keep you from some of the worst of that.
My mom did an excellent job. We always say she had four children, and none of us are dead or in jail, so she did a really good job.
And your grandmother, too, played an early part,
yes,
right?
my grandmother's probably, you know, one of the closest people to me and a major inspiration.
So how does that work, and what kind of influence did she have? Because if you imagine a life like that, and that's what I have to do, imagine that kind of a situation, I'm trying to see a mom and a grandmother keep their kids out of that when they have to walk through all that stuff, get on the bus, come back to school, and how do you protect your child from that?
Well, my grandmother and my mother were like really embraced and loved in the neighborhood, so everybody looked out. You know, I was Bev's son, or you know, Miss Vi's grandson, so you know, there was a lot of looking out for, and the crime and everything wasn't that bad as in elementary school, where we just walked together in groups anyway, mm-hmm. and everyone knew each other. It was a small town, so there really wasn't any abducting or, you know, things like that that we concerned with now.
You had to worry about it. Your earliest memories of art, too, what are they? Because you started pretty young, and your teachers noticed at an early age that you had some talent.
Yes, a story that sticks out. I was a fourth grade, I believe, and we had a substitute teacher that day in class. So, you know, a substitute teacher just sitting in an art class. Here's some paper and pen, you know, just get through this day and we'll be all right. So I remember drawing in pencil and paper. It was a bird flying over a canyon. And the sub, you know, paid attention like, wow, that's a pretty cool drawing. You know, would you like to sell that? I was like, no, it's for my mom. You know, all my artworks was, you know, for my mother. So, you know, I give you $5. I'm like, no, 10. And this teacher actually offered me $20 in fourth grade. And I turned it down because, you know, I love my mama. And I wanted to give her this picture.
Wow, that's so great.
That's when I knew, you know, there was something different about me if people offered me money as a child for my artwork. So
now, did you tell your mom, look, this is worth $20, mom? So
yeah, you know,
I want this like on the freezer, actually, eye level.
Definitely. I mean, you know, she still hold on to things. So. Yeah. So you might still have it tucked away somewhere.
So you did that, and you were also making toys. We talked about it. I found out that you were making toys out of popsicle sticks, and I was just curious to know if you made those little bombs, you know, where you can kind of weave them together and you hit them at the wall, because that's what we used to do with popsicle sticks. You can actually weave the sticks together, and then you toss them, and they hit the wall, and they kind of pop apart.
Never seen that, but we actually used to play with firecrackers.
Oh, yeah.
We used to call it a slow wick, where we open up the wick of the firecracker and take the gunpowder out and retwist it, and it burned a lot slower.
Oh.
So we got to the point where we can actually kind of time it. So we would, you know, light a firecracker, throw it down, you know, when someone's walking behind us. I mean, and,
you know, you marry those slow wicks to my popsicle bombs, and we've got ourselves a toy. We need to go into production.
There you go. I don't know how safe it'll be, but you, it might work out.
You, at that age, I wasn't thinking about that either. So at 14 now, you taught yourself to cut hair at the age of 14? Is that right?
Yeah, got a cheap pair of clippers and started practicing with my brother in the bedroom. You know, it wasn't good at first.
How did he feel about that?
I mean, he was 4 years younger than me, so he really wasn't paying attention, you know, while I was practicing.
How do you not pay attention to your brother cutting your hair? But go ahead, you're practicing on him.
So, you know, then there were other little kids in the neighborhood where, you know, if I did mess up, I wasn't worried about them beating me up, so I used to practice on kids in the neighborhood. So there was this woman, I cut her son's hair. Her name was Miss Mary. She was a bus driver. And, you know, she was a really strict mom, so everybody kind of scared of her. Yeah. So one day she knocked on my door, and she looked. She said, "Did you cut my boy's hair?" And I was like, yeah. She said, "Here's $5. She was new barber and walked away. I was like, oh, wow, okay, so I must be getting good. And that's when I started practicing and doing designs and decorations in people's hair with the clippers. This was back in, well, like late 80s, early 90s.
So you were just doing kind of conventional cuts, and then you started working with razor cuts and designs and creating designs.
Yes, I used to use the hair trimmers to put elaborate designs in people's heads. And that's kind of made me like a local celebrity in my neighborhood.
Could you make a living? You were making a living, or you were making some money, a little bit?
I guess, yeah. Make, you know, buy a pair of shoes here and there, help my mom out with the bills. This is when I lived in an East Hills neighborhood in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And I was in a high school, you know, Taylor Alderdice.
Well, you became kind of barbered to the stars at a certain point, right? You were cutting hair for athletes later on.
Yeah, when I got older, I, you know, went into the barber shop, and you know, I would cut a couple of, you know, Pittsburgh Steelers or Pirates, you know, things of that nature, and they would come through. But yeah, it was pretty cool. It was fun.
Well, we actually have some pictures at our website, stateofthings.org, if you want to go take a look at some of the designs that you did. And I just want to say, if you got time after the show, I'd love a Tasmanian devil on the back of my head.
I'm retired, Frank. It's all puppets now.
Just one. The Taz was great.
Thank you.
So then in your teen years, so now you've got this going for you. You've got, you know, a little sideline, but you also started transitioning into rap and graffiti art, right?
Yes. Taylor Alderdice, 10th grade, met a good friend of mine even to this day. It's, you know, it's my brother from another mother named Marlon Thompson. He was a DJ and a producer. You know, he made beats. And, you know, he said, you know, why don't you write a rhyme? You know, I wrote my first rap and we recorded it. And we started a rap group called BNGP, Black Nation Gaining Power. We, you know, more militant. We were a blend, if you want to describe us. We were like a match between Public Enemy and Tribe Called Quest.
Mm-hmm. So this would be mid-90s that you were doing this stuff?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so what were your aspirations at that? And you were also doing graffiti, right?
Yes, yeah, so we kept drawing. He was actually in a commercial art class with me in high school where we, you know, just improved our graffiti drawing, animation, cartooning. It all ties in together. Mm-hmm.
Was that then an aspiration for you? Were you believing that this was going to be the path you were on, that you were going to take?
Oh, definitely. I wanted to be a rap star. Yeah. Definitely. So, you know, we got gigs around the city. You know, I claimed the fame as a rapper. I went by Light Black when I was an MC because the whole concept of duality always amazed me. Like, you know, light and dark and, you know, ugly, beautiful. It's like, but they both need each other to describe each other. So I was always fascinated with the dynamics of, I guess, the universe, period. So I just want to embody that as an MC.
Were you also going to pursue, what about your graphic art? Was that going to be part of, did you envision that as part of your career?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've always been multi-talented and did everything. So I figure once I get into the rap game, then I can sell paintings for lots of money. And you know, that was my plan as a teenager, early 20s.
Were you getting any commissions from the graffiti work that you were doing?
Yes, I became a muralist and a live performance painter. Yes, I painted, especially when I moved here, I was in Carrboro. I was introduced to a man named Juan Landis. He goes by Stage Presence. Social Memory Complex was his hip-hop crew. Mm-hmm. And I was a live performance painter for a rap group.
How's that work?
During the set, I have a blank canvas. End of the set, it's a painting. Wow. Like live, probably 20 minutes to a half hour.
Now, what happens to the painting?
Sometimes I kept them, sometimes they get auctioned off, or you know, gift to the group for, you know, letting me get on stage with them.
And what about murals then? What kind of commissions were you getting?
You know, businesses, daycares. I actually did a mural right on one of the main veins of Pittsburgh called Penn Avenue, you know, going through the east side. So,
and that would be like a public works of the city or somebody would commission that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm talking with Chapel Hill-based artist and puppeteer Tarish Pipkins, who performs under the name Jaghetto. And you can check out videos, by the way, of his work, and not only as a barber, but also as a puppet maker, at our website, stateofthings.org. And our conversation will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest today, Tarish Pipkins, an artist and puppeteer who creates work under the name Jaghetto. And before the break, we were talking about explorations in rap and graffiti, and also your exploration of the sort of the union of opposites, I think. Could I ask you to perform one of those for us now?
Sure, Frank. I have a piece called The Loud Silence. So probably perfect to tie in. All right. The loud silence, the peaceful violence, the beautiful ugliness, the sweet stench of my habitat, infested with clumsy cats who lack agility, staggering through the inner city intoxicated, drunk off negative energy that saturates lost souls, leaving them soaked, reeking of that sweet stench. Irritated by the silent screams, I cover my ears to try to muffle the loud silence, but the silent screams come from within. The beautiful ugliness of my environment, my habitat, where bright colors are tinted with shades of gray, smothering the radiance of color. Darkness commits acts of peaceful violence on light, constant rattles of shackles and chains jingling and jangling in my brain.
Artist and puppeteer Tarish Pipkins performing a poem from early in his career. I use that phrase union of opposites, which is a kind of a Jungian term, the idea of integrating opposites rather than sort of holding them apart. I mean, is that part of your project? Do you see yourself as trying to make sense of opposites in their form rather than push one aside or create a bright line between them?
I don't believe there is a line between them. Probably like the energy of, say, love and hate. I see that it's on the same line, but they're just on opposite side of that same line, but they're the same thing, just different sides of the plane.
Is that an idea that sort of occurred to you that you found yourself playing with even as a young man growing up, fourth and fifth grade? Was this something you noticed growing up?
I've noticed it as my art advances as an adult, because my visual work, I use heavy contrast, especially in my paintings, heavy shadows, so I actually play with, you know, light and dark all the time with my visual work. So I noticed that in my work as well.
We talked about the effort that your mother and grandmother made to protect you and keep you from some of the worst of what was, you know, a part of your environment at the time. So again, you can see this kind of inherent tension. At some point, you even made a conscious decision to just stop attending funerals and wakes, right? What was going on at that time? And tell us about the decision.
It got that bad. I consider myself a survivor of a gang war in 90, 91, you know, early 90s in Pittsburgh. Anyone who was there would definitely agree with me. Pittsburgh was making national news at the time. A lot of friends that I've known growing up with were just like being killed in the streets. It was ridiculous to the point I had to pull back because I just went into a dark place. To the point where, well, am I going to survive to the age 21? That was what me and my friends were asking ourselves. You know, so when we turned 21, we just threw the biggest parties because it was like an achievement at that time.
I mean, was that something that you decided on kind of as a small group, or was that become a cultural artifact, the 21st birthday?
It was probably just my neighborhood thing, but I'm sure everyone else felt the same because, I mean, even if people weren't being killed, they were being thrown in prison because the city of Pittsburgh, they enacted the RICO Act for gangbangers. So, you know, if you were affiliated and you got caught up in something, you were going down for a long time. So,
well, and the people who lived in your house and a spouse and a partner. And so a lot of people, I mean, this is where we see female incarceration go up because if you happen to share a house with somebody and you refuse to testify, you could go too under the RICO statutes.
Mm-hmm.
So this was happening nationally, and I think, you know, it gives us a real insight. I mean, you call yourself a survivor, but trying to imagine a young man at 12, 13 with that same sense that you're not going to make it to 21, kind of how you might behave, thinking you're not going to make it to the age of 21. And here your teacher saying, well, what about your career? Think about your future, young man. And you go, what future?
Yeah, I mean, that's I think that's an issue as far as minorities in public school system. You know, they focus on testing and mm-hmm. grades. Like, well, what if, you know, the kid didn't eat that morning and you're trying to find a certain route that's the safest way to school, you know, in bigger cities, that's an issue. And you want me to sit and concentrate, you know, and take this test where my cousin was just shot last night and I'm, you know, trying to deal with that. So there's a lot of outside obstacles that are, you know, just influence our kids that are not being addressed.
Meanwhile, there is a great deal of ingenuity and skill in just having to navigate that world. And so the tragedy is having taught in that environment in the 90s in Washington, D.C., which was at the time branded the murder capital of the nation, you know, I quickly realized that teaching children in mortal danger, who were in mortal danger, about things that were irrelevant to their community was maybe a non-starter. Maybe I should start with what they knew and a little bit of their ingenuity and work out from there. But that doesn't seem to be the approach that we take in schools.
Yeah, I mean, people deal with reality certain ways. We chose humor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I've been in situations where there was a fight or even a shooting and we would find something funny during that or, you know, afterwards if we all were okay. We're like, wow, did you see the face on that person? And so, you know, even when I met my wife, I would tell her stories and I would be laughing and she'd be looking at me in horror like, oh, my God, that's horrible. You know, how could you laugh at that? And I, you know, once I had that conversation with her, I'm like, wow, I'm desensitizing you or I'm just so used to the violence that it's become a part of me.
Yeah, that's your own.
I want to address that. Yeah,
your own coping mechanisms are. It's to some degree could be pathological if you weren't aware, self-aware as you clearly are. You joined an artist collective called Bridge Spotters and started to do. You talked about live painting, so that's when you began to do that.
Yes, the founder Kamau Ware, I met him and he said, you know, I do these art parties where, you know, we feature artists. We have open mic and we have a DJ at the end and have a party. So have you ever seen anybody do live painting, you know, or, you know, would you like to do or try it? I was like, you know, why not? So it happened. And, you know, we started doing these parties over a few years where, I mean, they were very popular.
Yeah.
We would feature artists. And then we had like the hot DJs in Pittsburgh at the time come and perform. So it was pretty cool.
Did you draw your inspiration from just what was happening at the time, or did you go in there with an idea of what you were going to do?
Most parties, we had a theme. So, you know, we would, feature artists like Jean-Michel Basquiat, for example. You know, Andy Warhol's from Pittsburgh. So we used to perform at his museum all the time. And this one event, it was Basquiat's birthday. So we did a whole show dedicated to him, and I did a live abstract painting of Basquiat.
And you just mentioned your wife. You met her at about the same time?
Yes.
We
called them MESs or Midnight Espresso series, where it was like a coffee theme where we made up a name of coffee and have the theme around that. Yeah, I was doing live performance painting. I was a spoken word artist as well. I was featured in both. So I was doing caricatures one night. And, you know, my wife walked in by herself. We had met. And I said, you know, have a seat. So we started talking. You know, they gave her a free portrait. And, you know, we both played hard to get. We always joke around. She came to a few more events before we actually exchanged numbers.
You didn't do one of those charcoal caricatures that they do at the amusement parks, did you?
I was doing, I think, colored pencil and marker.
There you go. Well,
it's basically the same thing, yeah.
Turns out, if it works, I think that's great. But now at some point, we're going to make the transition to puppetry. And to what extent, because anatomy is critical to what you do and movement, mm-hmm. and we're going to talk more about how you get your puppets to move in a way that is thoroughly authentic and believable. Was that a part of your art as well? Did you begin to notice human anatomy and sort of how these muscles all come together and move?
I was even as a kid, I always paid attention to anatomy, how people walked, how they moved, animals. And that translated to my two-dimensional drawings as well. Even when I do a portrait of someone, you know, I have fellow artists or teachers told me all my pieces had movement to them. Hmm. And I never really, you know, understood till a few years later where I would, you know, really look at other people's work. And my work does move. It's always in motion if I draw a person. And anatomy is my thing. So portraits, you know, people's bodies, that was my strong point. Only natural to translate into puppetry.
So that may have been what that fourth grade substitute teacher saw in your bird flying over a canyon.
Probably, yes.
You've got motion in that.
Motion and movement.
And it's fascinating, too, to think about a portrait because we think of that as kind of a very still, you know, kind of a still object, right? I mean, I'm not moving, but the fact of your animation, the fact that you're alive and stuff is moving in you is probably the difference between an interesting portrait and one that's not. If you actually look still, I may not be interested, right? But there's cells and all kinds of things buzzing around that, you know, is not visible to the human eye. But somehow, if that gets reflected, could be the difference. Who knows? So now, but puppetry, let's talk about making the leap. And I guess your introduction to Fred Rogers.
Yes, I was actually doing a live performance painting on a local show in Pittsburgh. And, you know, his Fred Rogers studio is there because, you know, he's from Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. So I was leaving the studio and I heard a bunch of adults, you know, saying, Fred, you know, Fred. So they were like really happy. So I turn around and Fred Rogers is coming up the hallway with his sweater on. You know, I'm like, oh, my God,
sweater.
Mr. Rogers. So I reverted back to a kid. You know, my wife was pregnant at the time. She was pretty far along, like 7 or 8 months. And, you know, he walked up and he said, you know, how you doing? You know, Fred, I'm like, wow, my God, you know, trying to keep cool. And, you know, this is before smartphones and stuff. So I had a photo album with actual physical pictures of my artwork. I carried it with me. So, you know, he said, come on back to my office. So we went in his office and we sat with him for probably like a half hour. We were talking about art. He was going through my art and we were discussing different mediums and his favorite guests. It was just a...
Wow.
It was magic.
So from your reaction, I take it you were a pretty big fan.
Oh, huge. I mean, I grew up on...
Yeah.
On Mr. Rogers, yes.
So then, and you decided then to paint a portrait of Fred Rogers.
Yes, I was in the mode of doing that. And matter of fact, I was on my way to, I think, a supply store like Home Depot or something like that. And I was listening to NPR in Pittsburgh. Pulled up, ready to turn the car off, and they had made the announcement that Fred Rogers has passed from cancer, and I just was blown away. I actually, like, burst out into tears, like, uncontrollably, and actually walking through Home Depot trying to, you know, that after cry, like,
right.
You know, doing that, and it was just like a family member passed. That's how much influence he had on me, just that half hour.
In what way, though, did he influence you?
Just the love energy that he radiated was amazing. I really can't explain it. Like the presence that you see on television, that was really him. It was a sincere, beautiful energy.
And he was interested in your art.
Yes. It was, there are no words, you know. I mean, I even get choked up a little bit when I think about it because he's such an amazing person. And the influence that he had over children through puppetry. And, I mean, my main thing, when I seen the video clip of him when it was years ago, like 50s or 60s, when Congress was going to try and eliminate public television.
Right.
So he went before Congress. Instead of getting his budget cut, they, like, doubled the budget because he was so awesome. So, I mean, just him in general. I just want to be more like Fred Rogers.
And so is that what made you decide to start making puppets?
Seriously considered it. Yes, that was my main inspiration.
Wow. Had you been thinking about it, though, up until then?
I was playing around with it, and I was getting good and finding different materials. And, yeah, I was being pulled into it. I never thought that I would be a puppeteer until I actually started building them. Never had a thought
in my mind.
Did
you ever finish the portrait of Fred Rogers?
I did not.
Yeah,
there was no one to give it to. So,
so what about puppetry? What did you do at that moment then? You obviously, you became more serious. Tell us about those first puppets and who your subjects were.
Yeah, when I was still in Pittsburgh, I was still with the Bridge Spiders. And the founder actually got a art gallery in downtown Pittsburgh, and I worked there, and I used to host open mics, you know, poetry nights. And what I did was I built my first puppet. His name was Dobie Livewire, because I used to do these wire sculptures where I just wrap wire and they turn into a figure. So I just took it a step further and put joints on it and clothes on it and started making it move. So I would host the poetry nights with this puppet, and I built a small set, and, you know, he became, you know, a little popular in the poetry ring. And he was one of the few that I built there where I wasn't performing it. That's the only performing that I was doing. And then I didn't start, you know, performing with puppets till I moved to North Carolina.
Yeah, because there's puppet making and then there's puppeteering, right?
Yes.
You know, those are two different. So you've got this wire sculpture. You give it joints. How much thought went into the movement at that point, or are you just trying to animate what you've already made?
I was just animating, and it was basically he was just a host and a MC and a poet. So I basically just concentrated on his facial movement, his mouth. And I actually made a little microphone out of some scrap wood or something and put it in his hand.
So when did you then go from that to actually deciding to design marionettes? Or is that it's obviously on a continuum, but it feels like that's a bit of a leap from taking a sculpture to designing a marionette.
Yeah, I mean, it was all natural to me, actually, you know, just to pay respect to the art and it's so much going on with puppetry, different families, different, you know, styles. So I went online and started researching and figured I was like already halfway there because, you know, you have people who build puppets and that's just what they do. Then you have people who actually are puppeteers, but they don't do both. Mm. I mean, there is a population who do both, but it's not as much as, you know, people who do either or.
Would you find that there was a lot of transfer from your artwork, again, where you had already become pretty well known for incorporating motion in two-dimensional designs and sketches? Did it transfer easily, or is this a whole different animal?
It all ties in together. It was a natural process. I mean, me being multi-talented from painting to writing to building things, I can still do all of these things and just call myself a puppeteer. Versus before I started doing puppetry, you know, I would bore people to say, well, what do you do? Like, oh, I cut hair, I paint, I draw. And after the third or fourth thing, the eyes rolled back right in the head. And
so you're unemployed. And so it does.
Exactly. So puppetry, I can write a script. I can paint a background. I can build a set. I can literally build a puppet. But my art style, even when I paint, I don't sketch anything. I just go right into it and just start painting shapes and tie the shapes in with the detail at the end. That's with the puppetry. I don't actually draw the puppets out. There's no plan or blueprint. I just start cutting the pieces and putting it together, and it comes out how it is.
What's the story behind the name Jigetto?
I was watching one of the last movies that was released by Disney of Pinocchio, you know, with my son. He was my 13-year-old, who was two at the time, two or three. So I was reading the back of the DVD, you know, in the story of Geppetto and Pinocchio, you know, in Italy, this and that. And I'm like, Geppetto. And I was like, I do need a name. Like Geppetto looking. And I was like, Geppetto, Ghetto, Jigetto. And it just hit me like that. The light bulb went off. So I ran to my computer and I Googled it. Nothing came up. So this was when YouTube just opened up. So I just started, you know, putting out little corny videos of my first corny puppets and just putting Jigetto on everything.
Yeah, but that kind of stamps you at the moment. Mm-hmm. So how'd you end up in North Carolina?
My wife took a job with AmeriCorps, and we just decided we wanted to change. Just to leave the city. And we researched. This is in 05. And we researched the public school system in Carrboro, Chapel Hill, and decided just to take the chance and just move.
Well, you're still here, so maybe
still
you like
here.
It.
I think I like it here.
Talking to puppeteer and puppet maker Terish Pipkins, who creates and performs under the name Jigetto. We'll talk more about his career and how he ended up helping Missy Elliott make puppets and twerk on WTF. All that just ahead on The State of Things. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Chapel Hill-based puppeteer and puppet maker Terish Pipkins, who performs under the name Jaghetto. So, you know, we've got you now making puppets, cutting hair, painting, writing, all that sort of thing. And then you also teach or taught for a while and yes. At the Just Right Academy. So tell us about that, because you were there right from the start, right?
Yes. Six summers ago, I was doing a puppet workshop at a camp in Pittsburgh called Clapping Hands Farm. And it was a week-long, you know, puppet workshop with, you know, kids with challenges, special needs, whatever. And the director of Just Right Academy, she had a daughter working there as a counselor at the time. So after that week was up, you know, Linda, you know, introduced herself. And she said, you know, hi, my name is Linda. Would you like to teach at my school? And I was like, whoa, like, I'm not a teacher. But if she explained what she said to me, which, you know, sticks to me to this day, was she said, I see your passion for the children and your interaction, but I can teach you how to teach. You know, would you like to try? So I was actually running a group home through Youth Quest with my wife at the time. So I, you know, I agreed to do part-time and, you know, just to give it a try. But, you know, 6 years later.
Well, tell us about Just Right Academy.
Just Right Academy, it's a private alternative school for kids with special needs. Linda McDonough, the director, Marion Hauser, assistant director. We started just us three, just Linda, wow. Myself, and Marion with 9 students. And we've grown to a staff of over 20 teachers, educators, you know, therapists, and about 60 students.
Wow. And you built a puppet called Mr. Skills.
Yes.
Right? Tell
Mr.
us about
Skills.
Mr. Skills
is the man. We actually do a social skills curriculum, and I built this puppet to teach our primary class social skills, you know, through this network. And it was just an amazing thing. I actually have a funny story. You know, our primary class K through second, you know, a couple of kids were having a rough day. Mm-hmm. So they really, you know, didn't feel like doing their work. You know, we all have rough days. So me and my coworker, Lindsay, we looked at each other, you know, how are we going to get the kids to do their work? I said, I know, I'll go get Mr. Skills. So I pulled out the puppet and I, you know, confronted the kids like, hey, you know, I heard you're not doing your work. What's going on? You know, do you mind finishing this worksheet for me? So the kids look, sure, Mr. Skills. So they knock out their work. You know, the puppet checks their work for them. You know? So the coworker just looked at it like, oh, my goodness, the puppet has more respect than we do. So I learned that was more of a motivator for a few of the kids to get their work done, too. So it's like if you finish your work by this time, you could have 5 or 10 minutes with a puppet. So I would bring extra puppets for the kids to play with.
What do you think is going on there? Because if you ask that child, I mean, even in second grade, they know. That it's a puppet. They know it's not alive. What's going on there?
I just call it the magic of puppetry. I mean, it even happens to adults, too.
Right.
I had done this one show. It was an adult-themed show about a hospice. So I built the puppets, and the director at the time was like, you know what? Let's just leave the faces blank, you know, because we're crunched for time anyway. So we still put the hair and the clothes and everything, but the faces were blank. But at the end of the show, adults were walking up to us like, well, how did you make that puppet smile? Or how did you get the puppet to cry? And I was taken back like there are no faces. So people were projecting their emotions onto the puppets. And these are adults. So, you know, the imagination of a child, you know, that would probably seem natural to us. But when adults do it.
Well, it leads to the speculation that it's precisely, say, their vulnerability, that the parts of them that aren't there are what humans would then tend to project into them.
Mm-hmm.
That become, I'm guessing at all this, and why we might just relate to them so deeply, because it's us. You know, we really put our, and they've given us the place to do it, whereas other human beings kind of push away some of their body language and say, you know, you can't go there, you can't know this about me. Puppet, you know, defenseless, right?
Yeah, just wide open, and people just open up.
Pretty incredible. But let's get down to the movement now, because I think this is something, again, that you're famous for. Well, you've also collaborated with Paperhand, which is a well-known puppet company, at least in the Triangle, in this area of North Carolina, for the majesty of their puppetry.
Yes, I mean, it's an honor to work with them. I'm actually in a current show, their summer show this year, called A Beautiful Beast. We're at the Carolina No, we're at the Forest Theater, right. I'm sorry, on UNC's campus through next week. Then we'll be in Raleigh at the Museum of Art. And then the weekend after that, the weekend of the 18th, we'll be in Greensboro at their Carolina Theater in downtown.
Now, they've got these sort of giant puppets that are, you know, sort of parade-style puppets.
Yes.
Do you marionettes, or are you also learning
I've built some really big marionettes for this show to try to keep up with their scale. Actually, I built a 8-foot centipede for a first story of this show. And there's a third story that involves a wolf. I'll just say I want to give too much,
okay.
But actually built a wolf skeleton that actually moves and runs for the show. So it's a little different this year because they pulled me in to add to the show, the creativity.
Do you have to, I mean, it's one thing to, again, I'm thinking about the scale now and these unique puppets for various kinds of productions. Do you think a skilled marionette, a marionetteer, a puppeteer could take one of your unique creations, something to scale like that, and just get to work and make it work? Or do you have to sort of learn all over again because of the scale and the style of a particular puppet made for a particular production?
Well, I try to simplify my puppets to where anyone can work it. I try to make them user-friendly versus being complex. It looks complex and complicated as far as the movement, but as far as the controls, you're just turning one control up and down, but it has a lot of movement with that one flick of the wrist.
So what's your process then? How do you make that happen as you're building it? As you say, you don't sketch it first, so you're just cutting out.
It's just all trial and error, and I think I'm like 80% success rate now as far as trial and error, where I have an idea and it actually works. But, you know, sometimes I would build a puppet and it would just be a slow train wreck and I have to take it apart and redo it. But it's all about the process and problem solving. That's what I get out of it. I like to find a problem and fix it.
Because I would think even, so for instance, let's take us through this, the skeleton of a wolf.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you're going to have to create some of the motions of a wolf that we would expect so that we're going to believe that this is a wolf. But it's also not a wolf in a way, right? I mean, it's a kind of apparition.
Mm-hmm.
Does that change how this thing will move?
In my world, it's a wolf.
Wow.
I built a wolf. I Google image and I actually downloaded images and I just built it's actual full scale skeleton made out of PVC, wood, and cardboard.
So. You wrote your first stage production 2 years ago called Spinocchio.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
It's the story of an android who wants to be a real B-boy. Yes, I'm totally playing on the whole Pinocchio story.
Wow.
But we call it Afrofuturism. I collaborated with a good friend and business partner of mine, Pierce Freeland.
Mm-hmm.
So I got together with him, met him a few years ago, but, you know, we're both so busy, you know, we would see each other in passing, like, you know, we're still going to work together. But finally we connected, we sat down, and he actually told me he was acquiring another building for his teen center. We renamed it Black Space.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm the director of our Chapel Hill hub called Planet Puppets. And he's in downtown Durham on Main Street. We call that Planet Beats.
Well, tell us how all this fits together. You talked about Afrofuturism and the sort of the creative arts, and they're coming together. But it does have a kind of a social, political component as well. How do these things all come together?
I mean, I'm just pouring myself into my art. I see injustice. I like to confront it. And I think the only way that actually works as far as protesting or, you know, boycott, I think that my voice is most heard through my art. So I use my activism through my art for as puppet shows, especially the show Spinocchio. We're really confronting police brutality in this puppet show. So even though it's distant future, you know, we're just addressing today's issues because I guess, you know, injustice on people is timeless. It never goes away.
Well, and Afrofuturism has a history as well, and it is still alive, and I think that's one of the more interesting things. Maybe you can even tell us a little bit about the genealogy and where you fit in this history of Afrofuturism.
Yeah, I was always fascinated with robots. So I actually did a show with Paperhand years ago called Love and Robots. And it was funny because when they came to me with the idea, I was like, dude, I already have like 3 or 4 robot puppets already that I didn't even have to build for the show. So it was just a smooth transition because I didn't have to recreate anything new for it. I was just doing what I do and just added that label to it and just working with other people who are in that this underground culture where it's, you know, young Black people that are into sci-fi and comics. So we're just being activists right. through our art form.
So how did you get to know Missy Elliott and Pharrell and start working with them?
Like I said, I was an MC, you know, way back in the day in Pittsburgh. And I actually did a couple of shows with a friend of mine named Terry Davis. He goes by Izakiza now. He's signed with Timberland. So that's how he knows Missy. You know, he said he was talking to her and, you know, she pitched this idea. She wants a puppet in her video. So he reached out to me on Facebook, you know, plugged me in. I spoke to Missy through a three-way through him, and it all jumped off from there.
But originally, there was another puppet designer, right, that you had to sort of rework to make it work for her video.
Yes. When she pitched the idea to her producers, which is Hi-Hat Productions, you know, they hit the ground running, and they went to a really famous puppet maker called Zach Buckman of Furry Puppet Studios. He actually has studios in New York and Cali. So he built the puppets, and they went ahead and just went ahead with the project. And I didn't come up until, you know, months later because they had the puppets built. They were sent, and they were out in L.A. auditioning puppeteers, and no one could make the puppets dance like, you know, she wanted them to. So she's like, look, I got this dude in North Carolina and this other guy named Rich Atkinson in Jamaica, they're puppeteers, you know, get them out here. So we went out, looked at the puppets, and I tried to make a dance. And, you know, I actually went to Missy. He was like, look, I have to modify these. I have to, you know, remake them because they're not as loose as you want them. And so they went and got me all the supplies, and we set up shop right in the dance studio.
And it is amazing. It is a sight to behold. Here, we're going to give you the audio. You have to go to our website to actually see the video of this. But let's take just a little sample of WTF. It's just a clip from Missy Elliott's WTF. But the puppeteer who got those puppets to twerk just the way Missy Elliott wanted to see him is with me today on the State of Things, Terrence Pipkins. Was that a pretty amazing moment for you when she said, okay, these were, and your puppeteer, you talked about the puppeteer who is from Jamaica who actually kind of danced these things to life, right?
Yes. Yes, I worked side by side with him. It was just a dream team because I'm cutting and throwing them back together. He's taking and manipulating. There was a third puppeteer as well named David, I'm sorry I lost his name, but he's a veteran in Hollywood. He's worked on major films as far as graphics and everything. He's actually the one who rebuilt the set of hands for the Pharrell puppet to play the drums with. So that's me on the, you know, the drum bucket, but, you know, he actually molded the hands to fit around the sticks.
Well, talking about puppets and music, there was actually a story that you tell. And again, I think this speaks to how well you capture motion or release motion, I should say, in your marionettes. You had a cellist, right? A puppet cellist.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, tell us about that, because that apparently grabbed the attention of some musicians, right?
Yes, I actually had a really good friend named Barrett Black, classically trained cellist, and he was a neighbor of mine when I lived in some artist lofts. So that's basically what inspired me to build the cello player. So, you know, I was like, well, cello is my favorite instrument. How can I play a cello without practicing for 20 years? I was like, I know. I'll just build a puppet. So it's like, you know, that's how I approach my puppetry. You know, I would miss doing something like I kind of miss painting. So I build a puppet that does live paintings. Mm-hmm. I build a cello player. I've built an MC puppet who actually raps. So anything I would think of a motion or a function that no one's done yet, and I try to make a puppet do that.
But apparently not only did it work for you, it also worked for musicians who saw this thing and assumed you must be a cellist, right?
Yes, actually, I was at a festival at Jordan Lake, as a matter of fact, and there was a house band, and the band leader actually walked up to me and asked me if I wanted to sit in with his band. I'm like, dude, I'm not really playing this. I'm just a puppeteer. I was like, if you want to, you know, play around Bach, my Bach recording, we can do that.
Well, could you just sit and watch the cellist and learn from your puppet how to play? Why not?
Yeah, I mean, there are people who actually told me that I actually could pick up a cello because I have the movements down. Yeah. So, you know, hopefully if I get a couple extra thousand, to throw away, I'll buy a cello and start practicing.
So what's next for you? Are you going to continue on this? Other productions in mind? Where are you headed?
I'm going to build on the Spinocchio story and have episode two, because we put out our shows are half hour episodes because we're coming from like a comic book perspective. So the shows are episodes. So, you know, the episode one was really successful at the National Museum in Durham. They invited us back to do the second episode. So me and Pierce are sitting and writing that now. Just getting heavily involved with the Teen Center, the Black Space, you know, as director.
And you got your Puppet Hand production, which is on stage now.
Actually, my son Taryn is actually in the show with me. He's 8 years old. He's an amazing puppeteer.
And you're an 8-year-old puppeteer, and your 13-year-old son was an actor.
Yes, my son Divine is a star in a local film called There's My Angel, produced by Wake Productions out of Raleigh. And they had a showing probably like a month ago at the Carolina Theater downtown. So I'm really proud of him. He's awesome.
Family full of artists. Tarish Pipkins, who performs under the name Jugetta. What a pleasure. So good to talk with you.
Oh, thank you, Frank.
Take a look at his work at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program was produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton, Orman, and Katie Barron. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brett Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.